behind the back. Welcome to No Direction Beyond, your Starfinder news, reviews, and interviews podcast. I'm your host, Jefferson J. Thacker, also known as Param, and I'm joined by...
Alexander Argunas, the Everyman Gamer.
And I'm James. I write Code Switch.
And if there has been one thing that the No Direction Network has received in emails dozens and dozens of times, it's that y'all really liked a show that Alex and Anthony used to do. Yes, I'm talking about the venerable and wonderful Create Demiplane.
Yes, it was a special segment that we used to do as part of the Private Sanctuary podcast.
Yes, the former Private Sanctuary podcast, which was wonderful.
The podcast formerly known as the Private Sanctuary. Yes.
Now, technically, we could do another Create Demiplane here. There's no reason we can't. Starfinder has magic. Eventually, we could create our own demiplanes. Wish exists.
I feel like it might already be a spell.
But we're going to have... We're going to limit our scope. Actually, we are limiting the scope compared to an entire plane. So instead, we're introducing the Create Demi Planet segment. Moving on in the No Direction Beyond. And Alex, explain what we will be doing through the course of Create Demi Planet.
Well, throughout Create Demi Planet, we're going to be creating an all-new solar system that players can adventure in. The idea is that Starfinder allows for a galaxy of gaming, so why not have our very own No Direction galaxy in it that we can totally talk about and we can build together as a community?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Whoa, is that a tagline, galaxy of gaming?
Yeah, Owen made it for when we were starting to do the Rogue Genius game stuff for the Blood Space campaign setting. We used to talk about it a galaxy of gaming for, you know, Starfinder compatibility. So yeah, I totally just snatched it, Owen. By fight me for it.
I mean, it was really cool. I thought you were really cool on the spot. No, it's really kind of cool.
I'm sorry, I'm not that great. No. I mean, it's almost like I steal taglines and break pop filters out of nowhere.
And. Dishonor on you, dishonor on your cow, dishonor on your whole family.
Hey, Betsy didn't do anything.
Yeah, so, called Create Demi Planet, but it's more going off of the idea of like a solar system and working our way around. Because a single planet, while varied in its biomes as a place like Galarian can be, Galarian is way too stuffed as a planet to work ecologically. Mm-hmm.
And so the other thing is that when you start talking about planets in this genre, we know that Earth is a diverse world with plenty of different biomes and environments that are very intrinsically intertwined. But when you look at a lot of this type of like star finding, star traveling stuff, usually a lot of the planets end up being very similarly biomed, I guess you could say, where like, you know, you have like Hoth, the snow planet. Eox, the dead planet. Everything in this planet is covered in candy. And, like, you could break away from that, but the more detail you start putting into these worlds, the more difficult it becomes to actually get players into them. Because try, like, just try telling your players that they're landing on an Earth-like planet without using the words Earth-like. Like, how do you describe that? I think it's really tough.
Elm class? I think that's the phrase. Elm class?
Yes, M class, obviously. What? M for Mother Earth. I don't know if that's so familiar, Param. That sounds very science-y.
Yeah.
I'm ashamed at your lack of inner Trekkie.
I tried, and I was like, Tribbles were cool, though. I liked the Tribbles. Oh my God, they were soft and fuzzy and fun.
I mean, Enterprise is my jump in, but yeah, most planets aren't monocultured when they're places that are habitable. Yes. As far as big asterisks, because we only have one that's habitable. But like places like Mars are generally pretty similar across their whole biome. So we're looking at planets that you can kind of live on, and differences in climate beget more differences in climate that allow livable places to live.
Yeah. And so, like, as you go through, you can certainly, like, start diversifying your planet. Once you have a really big picture idea and you could, like, start filling in those details. Like, if you have your snow planet, but this one place has great, you know, ice glaciers that focus sunlight and make it warmer. Like, you could do that, but you need to be able to describe to your players what each planet is about. And as much as M-Class is charming, saying that you this planet is like Earth is like an easy way to describe what things are like. Being able to quickly to convey a lot of information about a planet in a small number of words, not necessarily from us as writers to you as consumers, but to you as GMs, to your players, is really important. We don't want you to be burdened by the amount of stuff you have to convey. That's why when you look at a lot of nations in Galarian, for instance, a lot of those nations in Pathfinder can be distilled to maybe a sentence of pertinent information, like Cheliax, devil, tyrannical empire. Well, you know, you have a fascist regime run by devils. There you go. That's what I wanted. Or you have Minkai, Japan, but with Oni. Like, that's kind of what it makes it easier to get people invested, and then you can start showing them other cool things. So you need to have these sort of big picture ideas in place so that you know where you're going and you know how to subvert things later. Subversion doesn't really work if there's not a baseline to build off of. So when we're talking about our awesome No Direction planet system, we should probably start looking at some big ideas that we can later distill. Of course, there are other ways to do world building, too. You can start off with really small things and build your way up. That's really good for a home campaign if you want to design, like, a space station in this unknown galaxy, and that's where you're going to run your very first adventure. So you go crazy making this space station. You fill everything out along the way with it. That works when you're a GM, and it's honestly probably a better strategy because it lets you get to the game quicker. But when you are trying to do a big setting like what we're doing, it makes more sense to start with big details and work our way down.
Yeah, I mean, my 10,000 pages of Big Eye Small Mouth campaign setting really was unnecessary.
No, but it was so good. You had street names for every street that we crushed on that giant tank. It was great.
Hold on. Breaking format.
Yeah.
Going to have giant tanks? Is that what you're saying, Alex?
We could have giant tanks, but I'm pretty sure what James is doing is that when we played his Big Eyes Small Mouth campaign, he went and he custom made a Google map of Tokyo, and then went and penciled in like businesses and street names all over the place for his campaign. And it's the most impressive map I've ever seen. And I'm guessing James couldn't find it because of the move.
Yeah, it's still packed up and we put it in the basement. But yeah, it was a 4-foot by 2-foot map of metropolitan Japan with all the street names blacked out that I printed out at Kinko's that I would use to mark what buildings they destroyed.
It was great. So I want to point out that like we were unwitting passengers on the tank.
I know. And also you're unwitting in the amount of dynamite or gunpowder that you used to blow it up. The answer was was an excessive amount.
It was a lot of gunpowder. But what were you going to say, Param?
I was saying push your mic back 3 inches. You're peeking on every word.
You're bombastic.
Yeah. You get excited. You're timid at the pre-recording, and then when the show starts, it's like 11.
Congratulations. You've met the character of the Everyman Gamer.
But yeah, so starting with big details, especially in a home game, can really leave you there with your pants down holding a lot of stuff still in your hands.
Right. Yeah, but you were great at that because you had so much detail around that whenever we wanted to do something, you were like, I have a place for that. Congratulations. Yeah. Do you remember that one time you made us take a bus route and named every single street we took along the way?
Yeah. That was, man, I wish we could get into that more. I don't have enough. But hopefully this solar system setting allows you to play around with little things like that and get to those minute details.
Yeah, definitely.
And while it is bad, not going to suit our purposes to go Tolkien-esque in the amount of top level detail that we're going to do before we start talking about some of the fun parts, we are going to follow the adage that it's easier to paint on a canvas with a single line on it than a blank canvas. And so each of us, which we have not coordinated this in advance at all, is going to get a veto proof one giant broad stroke about this solar system.
Param, what do you mean by veto proof?
That means that whatever we say, the other two can't change it. We have to go with whatever it is that comes out first.
Oh, gosh. So this is where you pick your darling that you really don't want James to blow up.
Or this is mostly something interesting that we'll have to work around and have to develop. I don't think it's going to be a darling for anybody because we haven't yet had the time to emotionally invest in it.
That's true. I am not emotionally invested at all, except I'm totally emotionally invested.
Mm-hmm. Alex, do you have your broad stroke ready?
No, you're the lead host. You have to do yours first. You have to set the example for the rest of us, right, James?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, host senpai.
Come on, host senpai.
Okay. I'm going to say that the central star of this solar system is unstable and being maintained by a scientific array that's very susceptible to outside radiation. Therefore, there is a technological quarantine and check before any ships allowed to enter the system.
Okay.
Wow. Interesting.
We're going to need that in, like, writing somewhere because, oh, man, like, oh, man, I'm never going to remember that.
Yeah, the basic gist is if something comes in with unchecked tech, it could blow the sun up.
It's like Kepler. It's like the idea behind Kepler. Yeah. Okay. Kepler, West Virginia, is a place where a huge radio telescope is placed at the top of a mountain, and this town itself has a electronics like EMP free zone, so they don't interfere with those readings. Mm-hmm. If you didn't know about Kepler.
Okay. And now, James, what's your broad stroke?
My broad stroke feeding off that system. The planets in the system themselves are connected by a series of gates or warps that open up when they line up in a certain direction, which is relatively frequently, probably on the order of every 4 or 5 years.
Mm. Now, is this all at once or just random planets connect every now and then?
Random. You kind of like daisy chain down the line. Like, kind of, if you're Mercury and you were Venus, you'd probably have a lot more link-ups than you would if you were Jupiter and Uranus? No, Neptune. Jupiter, Neptune. Saturn, Neptune. I know my space day. I know my space. You know what I mean. So planets that are more that are farther out or have longer orbits will have this connection less.
Mm. Well, this means there'll be a lot of cross-pollination of species.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Or? Who knows? Maybe it's something where it's kept by a certain species. I don't want to go that far into it.
All right. Alex?
Is something going on in chat? They're all saying that we went away.
I don't see that.
I don't see that at all either.
It says everyone away, yes, normal, yes, yes. What is this? I'm so confused.
Are you in a different Twitch channel? Are you cheating on us?
Oh my gosh, I'm in a different Twitch channel.
For shame.
That is the worst. Okay. Mm-hmm. At least you can cut that out because I made a nice pause.
These Agunuses ain't loyal. Mm-hmm.
Okay, hold on for a pause. And we're back.
Okay, so the combined population of humans, elves, gnomes, halflings, and all races derived thereof make up for less than 5% of the population of the solar system.
Oh, okay. So we can't rely on humanocentric species.
Yes. Nope. None of them.
Wait. Like, are you defining this as the core races in Starfinder or
nope,
the core plus legacy?
Nope. The races that I named. Do you want Lashunta? Go for it.
Mm-hmm. So rename the races again.
Dwarves, elves, gnomes, halflings, humans, and any race derived from those.
So like basically the Pathfinder core races are banned.
Make up for less than 5% of the population.
Okay. We'll have to work with that. All right. So to start us off, our broad strokes, we have a unstable sun with a series of planets that are interconnected randomly through portals and do not have a lot of human-like species living on it.
Oh, there's still plenty of human-like things that aren't those.
Right, but not the traditional fantasy races are not available, right. Or, well, are very rare here.
Right.
Okay, so I think that's a good set of broad strokes that we can go on. Mm-hmm. Alex, you have the most experience with creating Demi things.
I do.
So from here on out, you take the lead.
I am in charge now. Bow before my terrible power. All right. I'm done my Ursula laugh. Okay. So the first thing that you want to do when you're starting about talking about things like this, it really is helpful to kind of picture. So, all right. When we did the demiplane, the first thing that we talked about was general, like, conditions of the plane. We decided that it was a place that was frozen over because you didn't see ice very often. We decided a lot on the weather about things that made it weird and peculiar and strange. The thing that makes that difficult in a star system is that you have a whole bunch of different that by nature need to have different feelings associated with them. When you land on a Earth, it should evoke different feelings than when you land on a world like Mars or like Jupiter or like Saturn. Those are all different planets with dramatically different orbits, with different rotations, with different chemical compositions. They all need to feel different. And that's not something that you really see in a lot of demiplane. So the first thing that we should generally decide upon is a rough estimate of how many planets we think that there should be in the system, and maybe some types of planets that we think are cool in terms of just, like, you know, adjective planet. So, like, you know, if you're talking about Hoth, ice planet, water planet, donut planet, mm-hmm. just general terms, very broad. And we actually don't need the full number of planets that we have here. We could add more later, and we can ax them later as we need. So I heard you rolling dice, Param. Are you randomly generating planets?
That was James.
James, are you randomly generating planet numbers?
I mean, no, but I did get a 4.
Okay. Well, that makes sense, because even though they're, like, Starfinder's core Pact Worlds is really an exception to what you should expect for a how many of a planet in the solar system is populatable. If this really 4 is generous for how many planets would be in the sweet spot of an orbit that would be massively populated, especially, and if they're interconnected, that helps with that we have more than one that is livable on. So I think 4 makes a good choice for the number of major worlds that have developed societies on them that we would consider highly developed societies. And then the ones that are more out, either closer to the sun or more out into deep space, would be more exceptional types of populations than what we would consider a standard inhabited planet.
One thing that you have to keep in mind is that our current scientific definition of habitable planet usually refers to habitation by humans, meaning that you can have planets with dramatically different environmental biomes that maybe don't need the same things that humans need in order to survive. I think that's an important thing to keep in mind when we're talking about habitable worlds, because there's definitely a tendency to be humanocentric in this kind of design.
But to counter you, and I totally agree in the broad strokes, but if we have 4 of them that are humanocentrically habitable, this lets us play with James's idea of the portals that connect them, so that they would have throughout time been able, like, a portal to go to a thing that you just instantly die because all the air is toxic would suck. Also, if the portal opens is indiscriminate, then that those atmospheres would have been constantly exchanging between the planets. So I think it's safe to bet that at least the core 4 should be what we consider human populable, because we want the adventurers to be able to go here.
3 of them should be, and 1 of them should be horrendously toxic.
I like that. I like that. Other world. Like, that was just like, oh crap, every 100 years things suck because the poison death world opens.
The other thing to remember is that the worlds don't need to be inhabitable to humans. They need to be inhabitable to whatever the core races of the system are.
Or whoever
built the gates. So... another important thing to keep in mind is which races or ancestries or species, whatever you want to call them, which ones are the big players in this system? There should be a typical setting has somewhere in the ballpark of 5 to 7 or 8, with 8 being Pathfinder 2nd edition with the addition of goblins, and 7 being more traditional Pathfinder and Starfinder. So we should probably have a bucket of general, like, aliens. And when we're talking about them, we don't need culture. We kind of just need, like, feelings or looks. And typically a lot of these usually fall into a category of you've got at least one thing that's pretty monstrous. You have one thing that's at least one thing that's human or human-like. And you have at least a couple small creatures and on top of them. So we probably should get some ideas for what type of critters live in the system and why, how. Because the creatures that live here inform what the environments of the system are like. And that'll be really useful when we're actually getting to world.
Now, we don't want to blow too much of our potential early. Is this something we should say for a future episode, the species episode?
Maybe. Actually, I think that we should have at least, if 7 or 8 is the normal, we should at least have 3 or 4. And I mean, there are 3 of us, so why don't we each posit 1 major race?
That would be, that would line up to what James suggested, where 3 of the worlds are mostly happily habitable in the inter. So 1 major species that spawned on each world would make sense, because usually a planet only spawns 1 dominant species in sci-fi.
And you know, the fourth world could be just like awful aliens that want to.
Yeah. So each of us, each of us will do one. So each of us will do 1 species for 1 of the worlds, and then together we'll get up with what lives on the crazy death world.
All right. So before we do that, do we want to say yes to allowing pre-existing creatures, or do we want to say no and they have to be new?
I think we should do new, because if we're just going to deposit things, it's less fun.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm kind of that opinion too, but I'm not wholly opposed to things being there. But I think at least for these 4 going off, new races, at least initially, I think is a good idea
for these 3. Do it.
All right. Also, we should probably, whatever built the gates, are we going to do a Forerunner type situation?
It you doesn't necessarily explain that to the audience. You shouldn't make references that you don't explain.
Okay.
Halo.
Okay, so basically, the Forerunners, the ancient advanced civilization that was here before the current civilizations that left behind all the strange technology, would be a convenient way to explain these gates. Or it could have been one of the species. It could have even been the crazy death planet species that made them.
I like the idea that it is one of the minor races that doesn't have much power anymore. Like, they get to this group that was able to do these great leaps of technology just were unable to keep their place in their own system.
So maybe they're like on one of the far out, like long freaking orbit planets, like what would be equivalent to our Pluto. So they only connect up every forever.
That would be, I was also thinking, because like we were going over planets as places for habitation, but moons are also pretty fertile ground. And since they wouldn't be connected by gates, if you weren't using space travel, they'd be relatively remote. So if you were a civilization that said made these things and were somehow pushed out of those, you might find yourself on a moon in a place where they're not easily, your people chasing you aren't as easily able to get to.
But that all makes sense. But we should probably pick those races now.
I know. I'm thinking, I had a race idea, and I'm trying to grab it from the ether, because I was thinking about a couple things very recently.
Yeah?
Yeah. I mean, I just need to stare and do, like, I just need to stare at this unicorn for, like, a minute, and then I'll be fine.
Well, why don't I talk about some considerations for designing new alien lives while Parab and James come up with their ideas?
Well, I think we should save the species for the next episode. So, like, that'll give us time to actually put some work into it and then feature them.
We could.
Yeah.
I mean, if we were able to think a little bit about the planets, like one key characteristic for each planet, that would probably help inform.
Okay. Ideas. So what are the key characteristics? Yeah. Okay.
We know that one of those 4 planets is not inhabitable by denizens of the other.
You're right.
Why? What's there? What makes it uninhabitable?
It can't be crazy radiation, or it could be, and that's what's causing the instability of the star.
Magical radiation.
Yes.
Well, this actually brings up an interesting topic when we're talking about Starfinder in addition. When you're working on Starfinder stuff, one of the things that's most interesting is that you have the ability to make your worlds in the same general galaxy as the core Starfinder system. And this is an advantage because it means that characters in your Pact Worlds campaign can, you know, to go on a mission to this new system, and like now they're here and they have to deal with it. So that generally means that when you're building for Starfinder, one of the important things that you want to do is you want to make sure that it's got an approximately 300 to, you know, 250 or so year timeline lining up with some sort of major catastrophe that is similar to but maybe different from the gap. Mostly because that helps line events from the one world up to Starfinder, making them more compatible. So is this toxic radiation the result of some sort of gap-related cosmological event? I know in Bloodspace, instead of using the words the gap, because we can't publish the gap, we use Nova Age instead. Because in the Bloodspace campaign setting, it is a system with two binary stars, and one of the stars imploded into a black hole during the gap, now called the Nova Age because it went supernova. And the result of that collapse caused Bloodspace nebulas to appear all throughout the system. So if our bad thing in the system is the sun is unstable and technology could make it fall apart, is that something that happened because of this major, you know, Nova Age or whatever?
Well, if the bad planet is got magic bad radiation, it's pretty bad when it connects to another planet. It probably makes monsters and all sorts of fun adventure type things happen. But what could have happened is bad planet got linked to all the planets at the same time. One giant convergence, then gigantic, basically a gigantic radiation antenna pointed straight at the sun, made it super unstable. Calamity ensues. All sorts of bad things happen. We never want this to happen again.
World got the brunt of it, got it worst because of the four habitable worlds and the habitable range. It's the closest to the sun.
What if the gates act like a lens and they magnify this from outside of the system somehow as well? Mm-hmm. Or at least the initial burst of this radiation.
Okay, so that would work if it was actually... Yes, it magnifies it. It would have, in order for it to magnify and hurt the sun, it would have to be the one furthest away from the sun of the four planets. And then it just shoots that all straight at the sun through the gates. Massively.
But the one that would have the worst after effects would be the one where closest to the planet, or closest to the sun.
Yes.
Where it would have it most concentrated at.
Yeah. So the magic bad planet is the source of the bad stuff. And so, yeah, the one that of the four planets, the one that is closest to the sun is the most wrecked from what happened. And it's the one trying to recover the most from whatever the bad thing was.
See, what I was thinking was that the planet itself wasn't the origin of it being bad. It was this other calamity that was focused through it. And it's just dealing with the after effects of being this toxic wasteland.
Okay, but, so they're having to deal with the fact that now their planet is a toxic wasteland.
Yeah, like the people that originally built these gates didn't build it. Hey, let's just go to Dead Space World and all be terrible.
So, the planet is a toxic wasteland, but we were talking about magic. Does that mean that it's like literally poisonous, like radiation is, or is it stranger?
I'm thinking like mana waste. If you're thinking about primal magic.
I'm thinking of like Netherstorm from World of Warcraft.
I feel like that's kind of like the mana waste.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I do like the Netherstorm comparison.
Just like crazy magic clouds and storm. There's magic everywhere. I really like the idea of a planet where like a storm doesn't just mean your house might get washed away. Your house might get washed into like, you know, a giant foot that hops away because just magic is unpredictable and insane there.
Yeah.
You ever see the adventure of the episode of Magic Man turns Finn into a foot?
No.
That just type of weird, wild, and crazy adventure time random stuff is kind of what I'm getting as a vibe. Like, you know, to any sane person, it's not habitable, but like the entire planet's outlook is like that of James, or like, where else am I going to go?
It's a Tuesday.
Yeah, but that doesn't make it unlivable on. That just makes it inconvenient to live on, and it kind of goes, it subverts that it's completely toxic situation, because at that point anybody could go there.
So, but here's a counterpoint. Mm-hmm. If the planet is so toxic that nobody can go there, what's the point of having it in the system? Because the players are going to automatically assume they can't go. And if the player, the players are told they can't go there and they actually can go there, then we lied to them and there's no point in saying that they can't go.
There's differences in can go there and can't go there, as opposed to you can go there, but you have to wear a rad suit and like trying to go to Eox is in Starfinder. You can't go to Eox unless you wear protection and have all this gear ready. And for most of civilization, you couldn't go there because most of civilization, we didn't have rad suits and technology to protect us from it. It was just the planet that kills us every 100 years.
That begs the question, is the environmental protections of Arnor enough to protect you from this planet?
I would say for periods of time, kind of like how armor protections work now.
Yeah.
So the answer is yes.
Yeah. Yes, but this it pushed the limit. Like, this has got to be hard to do. It's expensive. It's not just, like, easy to be there.
Yeah, not just having 7th level suits, just getting you out of radiation death.
I still think that having a major planet whose purpose is to just be the no man's land is...
Well, there has to be something that's worth being there.
Right. So what is that thing that makes it worth going there? Because if it's just a wasteland with no reason to go there, there's no... like, why does it exist?
Well, you said yourself it doesn't need to be habitable. Like, it can have things that live there that's unique to there. It's just the stuff that adapted to that environment. It just is not humano-centric or our other three races-centric. It's like, they're fine there. They're the people that were... that's the species that was born in the toxic death soup and learned to survive and therefore will be quite terrible. And there's the species that lives there that is quite fine with the toxic death radiation because it was formed by it. It's just bad for us. Like, I would not survive stepping foot onto, like, Saturn and breathing all that horrible acid clouds.
Right, and why would you go there?
If there were super awesome space whales that lived in there, I'd want to meet them.
Helium.
I don't know if you'd actually want to meet space whales,
Perry. Let's be very clear. If in our reality we discovered a life form on anything, we would do everything to go say hi.
Yeah, I still want to die in space, and there's, like, not a real way to do that.
I mean, you just want to be shot out of a cannon so that your friends and loved ones can make wishes on your ashes.
Yeah, I just want to go to space.
I mean, on our own planet, there are areas where the air is too thin to breathe, and it is kill yourself to climb up it, but we still scale Everest. It just because it's hard to be there doesn't mean it's going to frighten us away from trying.
Yeah, we're really dumb. You know what our solution was to people freezing in Antarctica was? Send more people. We'll discover it eventually. And I would assume that other sapien races would have similar bouts with inspiration and stupidity.
and for adventurers to go there, there's probably some good reason to be there. I'm sure we can come up with a reason.
Yeah, I do like that there would be creatures that would be able to survive there. Maybe it's something where there's a chance of being magically warped, and that is something that can persist through. If we're dealing with lenses and crystals and magic interference, concentrated magic or aether, although it's kind of a cliche, in a system where tech has to be limited, something like that in the form of a form of a battery might be a prime energy source.
Oh, yeah.
Here is a thought. In the Starfinder campaign setting, nobody has drift engine until the goddess of technology gives it. Obviously, we can't use Triune in this setting because, hey, Triune is intellectual property. So, what if the crazy magical fallout resulted in a rare type of metal that is used in the construction of what is essentially hyperspace engines in this setting? Mm-hmm. That they haven't figured out how to make them the way the pack world make them, so they instead rely on this crazy, horrible hybrid magic machine that really should not work because magic cannot take you to the... but it's also technology. It's just powered by magic.
Like a magically infused ore.
And okay. I like... also, because the gates have... because the gates have resulted in a lot of cross-pollination, they have been able to explore their own solar system. They haven't needed... up until recently to do a lot of space travel, a lot of space development. Mm-hmm. Therefore, the fact that this technology made it easier means that they probably aren't used to space travel as much as the Pact World's types are. And so if it is this super-powered crystal, it means, like, we're talking, like, early days space exploration travel where there's a 30% chance this thing is going to blow up and turn us all into chickens in space. Like, this is, like, the most dangerous way to travel ever, but it's the first chance we've ever got to do it.
I also like the idea that that material helps is what helps keep the sun stable as well.
Mm. Oh, yeah, they need it. And it's a limited supply, so they know they're going to run out eventually, and that's a big, major campaign. We have to solve this or we all die long-term.
Unless there's another convergence.
Yeah.
So here's a thought on the Starship thing. Mm-hmm. As much as I do not care for Starships and Starfinder, mm-hmm. they are a core part of the rules. Mm-hmm. The technology should be developed and be reliable enough that it's not like, hey, time for Starship combat. Oh, 30% chance your ship explodes and you're all chicken dust.
But space orcs.
I mean, it's great when it's the enemy orcs, but when you're the space orcs and that 30% chance blows up your ship, it feels really bad.
Have you ever played Kerbal Space Program? Getting to space is half the fun.
I'm gonna hard veto the idea that starships don't work in the setting, and that
I didn't say they don't work.
No. We mostly lean on that in flavor. Starships are incredibly dangerous, and maybe we've got ways in play to make it easier. But we have to have some rule where this is more dangerous than
you
normal.
You can't use flavor that isn't backed up by the mechanics. If you say that the starships blow up 30% of the time, and the players are never at risk of their ship blowing up, then you lied to them. And that is one of the worst things that you can do as a setting designer. If your setting doesn't follow the rules of the game and you don't make accommodations for them, it's not real, essentially.
Oh, look at Alex Senpai. He looks like a rain cloud to me, doesn't he, Param?
Yeah, he really does.
I'm sorry. But after a certain point, if you're going to take away you're not really playing Starfinder.
So,
most of that last sentence was completely destroyed by internet lag. So I don't know what his good lecture was at the minute there.
No, his thing was like, just don't lie to players. Give them stuff that's actionable.
Okay, so 30% is too much, but I think it should be more dangerous because we're using crazy tech.
I'm kind of on the zero. I just like the 40K orc idea of technology where it's like, yeah, there's definitely holes in the spaceship, but it's still fine.
Mm-hmm. You can put it in as like, this happened in the past. Our ships used to have a 30% chance of blowing up. Now it almost never happens. That's fine.
Yeah.
But if you tell the players that there has a 30% chance to blow up and nothing in the Starship combat rules backs that up, you're lying to them and automatically take your setting less seriously because
you're the only one saying 30% anymore, Alex. We abandoned that number a long time ago, but if you want to keep harping on it.
I was still on the 30% train.
If it's any percent greater than zero.
What? That is unequivocally false. America still has problems with our rockets exploding.
Yeah, seriously. But we also there has to be some amount of danger.
You can have danger that doesn't involve the starships.
Okay, so every so often while you're traveling on these ships, it magically warps freaking horror monsters into your hold that you have to deal with. So space travel in this area means that you have to have a security contingent that's just ready to lock this sucker down in a moment's notice.
That is something actionable that you can provide rules for. Also, that happened in a Dead Sons game and we were terrified.
Yeah, this is actually kind of like Outwall Starry, where these magical ships do need wards to protect them from the genesis of their own materials.
Mm-hmm.
That's actually pretty cool.
You could also have, you guys have heard of Solar Wisp? James, I know you know what a Solar Wisp is.
Yeah, it's a, yeah.
Maybe they come out of this unstable sun as giant globs of plasma, and you might have to fight living starship-sized versions of them if you're not.
Yeah, or
there
just
needs
whatever
to be starship-sized monsters in this place. This whole world screwed.
Maybe there are versions of them that are formed fully out of magic. And so if you're not careful, this thing could hit your starship, breach its hull, and now all of a sudden your starship has been turned into literal bread. And now you're all dead in space because your starship is bread.
Wait, why would it be bread?
Because it's a transmutation magic ooze.
There's lots of other things to go besides bread and feet.
I mean, generally, when your ship gets breached, you're dead because of decompression and being in space now.
Yeah, but you have armor that might have let you survive, but now your ship is bread, and it's even worse.
Yeah, but what type of survival is it when you're floating in space until you run out of air? That is torture on its own.
There is always hope for repairing the ship, and then your ship is bread. Listen, we don't have to use the bread ooze idea. It is a noun picked to illustrate a point.
Okay, good, because you seem to really like the bread, and I'm like, Alex, I don't like the bread.
I'm all for it magically destroying things, but I'm more hoping for like weird crystals and demon stuff.
I want to point that I almost never get you distressed, so catching that on camera was wonderful, and it's
because we're in a form where I am incentivized to be polite and not use strong language. That's all.
All right, so we have star unstable, technology can make it explode, four habitable planets in the habitable range. One of them is horribly infused with magic that's irradiated it, and it's dangerous. There are terrible magic/ooze/monster things that could destroy starships, and unstable planar fabric in the area sometimes makes random stuff appear in your ship. It could make stuff appear out of your ship. Maybe you have a chance, like your ship has to make a will save, or all of a sudden your spaceship has an engine glitch because that engine is now 1 mile that way.
See, I think that gets to the point of the 30% failure rate.
Right. Yeah, but at that point, that's something that has to do with the environment rather than something with the ship. Do you see what I'm saying?
Now, to change it comparative to what we would normally consider Starfinder, maybe they have to underpower their ships to run them more safe. So, like, if when you push your ship, that's when it's more in danger of horrible bread demons.
So the worst part about that is that it justifies why skill checks get harder with your ship's tier in this.
Yeah, of course it does.
No, I actually like that as a rationale. Yeah, we're going slow because we don't have enough bullets yet to fight the demon.
If we go too fast, our engines might tear a hole in the space-time continuum, and then hell pours out.
Oh no, it's the cops. Let's risk damnation. Let's
Validation check has less to do with how finesse you have with a joystick and you're just chanting wards against the elder gods.
No, that actually sounds really cool.
Sounds really dope.
We revved our engines too hard and we tore a hole in the space-time continuum.
Quick, pray to get the ship back together. I actually generally enjoy this now.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you're only just enjoying it?
No, I was enjoying it now, but now this picture is getting a little bit clearer about like why things are the way they are, right. Especially as going in space. So yeah, no, I dig it.
So according to Einstein's theory of relativity, I'm sorry, I'm going to math science, James.
Einstein.
The weight of gravity distorts space time. So maybe whatever's going on with the sun is some sort of irregularity with the gravitational pull on space time, and that's kind of pulled the fabric of reality too thin in this solar system to the point where it's literally at the breaking point. And that magic aura that we were talking about is somehow able to repair the very fabric of space and time in this area.
Yeah.
Maybe it's through the form of like crazy, like almost ley line style satellite, like ley line satellites.
Oh yeah. That's what I was figured was around the sun, keeping it together. Yeah.
So now we have these magic. They're like a patch. You know, like when you're a kid and you trip and you fall and you tear your jeans and you get that big dorky patch slapped right on top of it because your mom can't buy you new.
You just wore them with holes in them.
Oh, my mom patched them. I'm sorry.
You can't do that with the sun, though.
Yeah. You do it with these satellites. You patch the space-time all around it with these satellites that kind of like project stabilizers. They're literally patching the jeans of the cosmos.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's a pretty good reason why things are bad, and it even allows bad things to happen even when everything else should be good.
Yeah.
And
because you know what's great? When you do everything right and everything is perfect and all scientific calculated odds say things should be fine, and then they're not.
Justin Riddler also points out that this will make random encounters on the ship maps more common and a reason to actually have them.
Yeah. Also, he says celestial speed limits, love it. Inevitable speed limit. The system is swarming with inevitable activity, because if this area breaks, something horrible happens that they won't talk about. But it's very Cthulhu.
Well, flip that on its side. Maybe the Inevitables want to make... This is supposed to break. And we're not supposed to stop it. And they want to make sure we don't.
Oh, we lost James. Where did he go?
We lost James!
Oh, it disconnected me. I'm back. It's fine.
Welcome back, James!
I don't know if necessarily using Inevitables as a basically counter to everything in the system enemy is fun.
Yeah, I agree. Also because they're really efficient. Like, if the Inevitable Lords decided they wanted your system to die, like, why would we have a campaign setting? Because they just do.
Especially if it's just sending, like, a walkie-talkie in.
Just launch the Furbies.
That's an idea. They're guardians by proxy. The Inevitables want to preserve this system, but they're predominantly made of technology in Starfinder, like the Nanite one in the Bestiary 2.
Oh, so they can't get too close.
They can't come in because they might demobilize and break the thing that they want. So, some other outsider race that is contrary to them, and you could say Proteans, but that's boring. We should pick something else. Some other outsider race is like, ha ha, we can do whatever we want here because you don't like it, but you can't stop us.
Azadas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're
exactly... Oh, but Azadas are good.
Yeah, but they're also kind of like that.
Beboleths.
That's not a race, that's just an extraplanar killing machine. Just an engine of death and despair.
I like James' idea if it's Azadas, because then, like, they're skirting the rules and stuff, but at the same time, you don't hate them for it. It's a way to have a good rated adversary.
Let's put that on a maybe for now. I'm not sold. I feel like unless there's a good reason for good to be there, it doesn't make sense to have them be the ones tearing apart fabric. You would need some really good reason for the Azadas to risk destroying everything.
I don't think they're here to risk destroying everything. They're there because they're doing something the Inevitables don't want them to do, and this is their only safe pocket to do it.
No, that seems more like an adventure arc than a setting theme.
That sounds like an adventure, like one Azada.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like Keith the Azada and his moonshine business. You know, he doesn't want to pay his taxes.
Oh, yeah. I don't want to pay these planar taxes. There's no pharasma.
By the way, he has like 80 ranks in profession banjo.
I mean, that's really impressive. He clearly took 4 masterclass bards and merged them together.
Is this where I'm going to have to flex my Kentucky pride and teach y'all how to make a moonshine steel?
I just watched a video on methanol poisoning. I do not even want to risk it.
I would be more impressed if you could whip out your banjo and teach a few.
I'm afraid I'm just going to have to disappoint you there.
Oh, he sounds so cool.
He did. He sounded so great. Listen to that Fallout 76 voice.
So we have our 3 planets. We should probably give it a little bit of time to think how we want to fill those out. Mm-hmm.
Is there any commonality between the species that we want to keep that like we all have to play by? Like, is there going to be some overall theme that when you see these 3 species, you know they're from our setting?
I would say no.
Okay.
Because that makes it look better.
Yeah,
one of them should be small.
Yeah, I whenever I think of like alien races, I still come back more to cultures rather than creatures.
Mm-hmm.
So like I have more ideas for culture than I do creature body type, and I feel like my idea of the planet will inform the creature type rather than vice versa.
Mm-hmm. So we're getting close to time. So what's our callback on our assignment is by the next time we do this episode, each of us has the basic of the planet, like the basic stick of the planet, and the species that lives there, right? For each of our planets,
one of your primary species there, yeah.
And you said, Alex, you said one of them should be small. Do you want dibs on small?
No, because if I do, I'm just going to make Skittermanders because I really want
Skittermanders. I know. I was waiting for him to just go Skittermanders. I was going to yell at him.
No. So no, don't give me the small one. Give James.
All right, I'll do it.
Because if we give Parham the small one, he's just going to make halflings.
Halflings. I'm not going to make
space halflings.
Yeah, you will. I know you.
You're going to make space Skittermanders. But
it's
like,
going to be. It's going to be. It's going to be halflings, but with antenna.
Oh, we're so weird.
They're called the Shuntalings.
All right. So we are coming up on time. This is a very important segment that we're going to be doing from here on out throughout the show. We do want some ideas from our audience. So what should our audiences be able to give us some feedback at? What should they be suggesting?
They should be suggesting all sorts of things. What could go wrong in this system? Also, if you agree with anything that was said or you disagree, make sure you you note it. Mm-hmm. We listen heavily to all the feedback we get for these types of things. Mm-hmm. Anthony and I had a tradition of reading pretty much every comment that we got at the start of each Create Demiplane episode. And while I don't know if it's going to be realistic for this, depending on how many viewers we get, I definitely want to be able to go through the list and share thoughts from the community while we work together and build this. James Parham and I will discuss how to do that based on how many of you give us feedback. But absolutely, please do. Maybe we could make like a special like thing on our Discord server. Our Discord server that you could join at the No Direction Network. Maybe we'll make a channel. I said,
King. Yeah, we mean Parham.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We mean Parham.
Who even linked it in chat? I don't even know. What cross branding?
Yeah, and if it's you're amazing. Listening, yeah, you can get to our Discord channel by going to nodirectionpodcast.com, and on the right there is a gigantic Discord button. Join that, you get on our Discord server, where you will find the most chill place to hang out and talk about Pathfinder, Starfinder, and any other related topics, as well as just the general geekery that we get onto. The entire No Direction community is there, and you'll also get to speak fairly frequently to all the members of the network. So if you want to chat with James, Alex, or myself just about any time, get on that Discord server. It's a great place to leave feedback for the shows and just sort of hang out anytime between episodes. Also, we have our Facebook page at facebook.com/nodirection, our YouTube channel at youtube.com/nodirectionshow, our Twitter at twitter.com/nodirection, all good places to reach out to us and find out more and give us your feedback. We really need your feedback for this segment. So if you got any ideas or any feedback for any of the things we discussed, help make this crazy solar system as much yours as it is ours.
When we started with Create Demiplane, we began kind of like this, where we just sort of hashed out some ideas and people commented. They told us what they liked, what they didn't like. They posited their own ideas. And then we started asking like specific questions. So I imagine like that's where we're going to get to. We'll be like, hey, this week we want to know what race do you think should live on the water planet? Because of course there's a water planet.
No, every planet should have water. That's just a thing.
Yeah, every planet should have water, but some planets should have more water.
But Earth is 70% water. How is that not the water planet?
Because you can go up to 100% water.
But that's dumb.
It's very. It's just a bubble. It's just a giant sphere of water. There's nothing else in there. Go and it's got a liquid. It's got a core of liquid hydrogen dioxide. And they're like, oh, this is great. No, it's just water.
I'm gonna veto that stupid plan. Also, we're probably going to be going back and forth between settings. Mm-hmm. I favor grimdark settings. Param's about halfway between me and Alex. Alex prefers very jovial settings.
Oh, man, you haven't read Blood Space then. I'm sorry.
We can't read Blood Space. You haven't published it yet.
It's called Blood Space. I've seen bits of it. It's called Blood. I understand what Blood Space is.
Are you sure?
I mean, it's called Blood Space. It doesn't. I mean, the theme is kind of there.
Speaking, kind of in the name. Speaking of live feedback, Justin Riddler suggests, would there be planar portals in addition to the planet portals? Something that we may consider in a future episode. And maybe. Logan Pup says that every planet should have ammonia lakes.
Ammonia lakes. That sounds like a very nice lady, Miss Ammonia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then you get into her and you realize she's acid and melts your skin away.
So it's a coffee house. Well, she's basic, actually.
Oh, that was good. Bravo. I don't even care how much I pop for clapping for you. I'm clapping for you. That pun deserved all of the pain it's going to take Parham to edit that out.
But so this looks like it's going to be fun going forward. I thought this was enjoyable so far. So
all right. So until next time, go beyond with No Direction.